right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I gotta get Spencer Davis's accent, the way he talks. Then everyone will stop and listen, yes. And then I will control the world. I don't want to control the world, though. That's the point. I just want to make the world a whole better place for humanity to live in, okay? And that takes all of us together doing the things that we got to do. And that takes actually listening to things like what we have on the show today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with actors Camille Spearlin and Karen Molina White from Runaway Home, a really, really, really fine play. And we'll talk about that when we get to there towards the back end of the show. Before that, we'll be talking to Perry from Refuse Fascism LA about the protest that blocked the 101 freeway, okay, just a few days ago. Then we'll be talking also about November 4th and how it's shaping up the beginning of people protesting every day, every night, until the entire fascist regime is removed from office. And before that, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Carl Dix. Carl is a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. And he's joining us to talk about all the racist filth that's been spouted by the Nazi white supremacist Trump, all the things that have been happening around all this, and the righteous response by hundreds of athletes and many others, okay? And plus, we will be getting into with Carl, November 4th, it begins, it begins, it begins, and it ain't gonna end till they are driven from power. That's pretty much essentially what they're saying. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, we got a certain amount of time, and I got about 18 pages of things I want to ask you, okay?
So let's get started.
Let's go. Whoa, pushy. All right, let's review what's broken out in the sports world, your initial take on what's happening.
Okay, I mean, look, the players who stood up, including all the way back to the beginning last year with Colin Kaepernick, who stood up by taking a knee, sitting down, and in other ways dramatically posing this question of refusing to honor a flag that flies over police getting away with murdering black people and other injustices brought down on black people and other people of color are right. They were right from the beginning and they remain right. And when Trump stepped into this situation, look at what he brought together. I mean, he began by calling the players SOBs, you know, which you're talking about people's mama right there. And he went on to say, you guys can be well-paid gladiators beating each other's brains out in the arena for us over the weekend, but don't any of you open your mouths and speak against injustice. And if you do, and especially if you do it in the dramatic way that you've done it, you should be out. You should be banned. You should no longer have that ability to be a well-paid gladiator. So he's pulling together blatant disrespect of black athletes and black people in general, enforced patriotism, slurs aimed at black women, and then he winds it up with, and they should let the players knock each other's brains out even harder. Again, not caring, not giving a damn about the lives and well-being of the people that he wants to see be gladiators in the arena for him and the spectators. And he did this in front of a lily white audience in Alabama with a lot of references to those people, which is code for those black people and other terms that you'd use on them. This is what he did, and it was very important that many more players stepped into the fray on this and joined those, because it had been a handful who were doing it, and then many more players stepped in, and then it spread throughout society. I mean, you go online and you see like a 97-year-old military veteran taking a knee in solidarity with the players and many other instances. But also you see a sharp division in society on this, because Trump, on one level, knew what he was doing. He knew there was a base for these attacks targeting black people, making the question enforced patriotism, and that people would line up with that. So there's a sharp division in society, and there's a question of which side are you on? And not just which side are you going to cheerlead for, but which side are you going to be on and step into the fray and act on, not only in relation to the protest of the players, but everything that gets bound up with that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to me, too, because when you were talking about what Kaepernick did and how in the beginning there were people here and there that supported him, and there was also a lot of controversy at a certain point, people talking about whether what he did was right, was it the right place to do it, was it the right time to do it. And then when Trump came out with this thing, and we do have to examine that a little bit later. I want to examine sort of the full implications of what Trump was saying, because it's very heavy when you think about this. But when Kaepernick did this, it was really, I mean, it's what you're saying. You saw something that was, and Trump responded. It set loose all kinds of things, both among all these football players and these teams, and even for whatever reason they're doing it, the people in the management positions and the ownership positions, some of them coming out and standing and making a statement around this. And it's really polarized things in a way that I don't think anybody expected to happen.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen anything like this in decades in the arena of sports. You know, you got to really go back to the 1960s, the Olympic boycott movement. You got to go back to Muhammad Ali and what he did, John Carlos and Tommy Smith. And here you had even a much more widespread thing. So it was very, very important that people stood up and wouldn't knuckle under in the face of this. And then the NFL is actually the owners, the league itself, they're in a contradiction, because this whole thing about the national anthem, and one thing that doesn't get spoken to anywhere near enough, is that it wasn't until 7 or so years ago that the policy became that the teams were required to come out during a national anthem. Prior to that, the anthem was played, the fans were supposed to stand up, and myself, sports addict who's been in a number of arenas where the national anthem was played, I have not stood up for the national anthem in about 50 years, because that anthem and the flag, I know the horrors that it flies over and that it symbolizes, and I've refused to honor it for decades. But they're in this situation where they have this thing of trying to use the sports thing to whip up patriotism. In fact, they got government contracts to do this, including the policy change that required the teams to be out on the field for the national anthem, as well as a lot of commercials that they run for the military. But it's really something that happened like 2009, 2010. And they have to both deal with the fact that they've got a league that is majority African-American players, and the contradiction that they'd have trying to suppress that while also staying in good with not only the government overall, but the fascists in the White House, which a number of the owners have close ties to. So they're trying to maneuver a contradiction there. And it's very important that the players step out and that they stay stepped out and that people stand with them. It is also important that we draw from this what it really means. I mean, we got to learn from this and act accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Getting to that point, that is exactly where I want to go in a minute. But, you know, one of the things as you were talking, I kept thinking about when was the last time, and you were mentioning some things, but even looking at this, you know, that Stevie Wonder, the anthem, the people that are singing the national anthem, Roger Waters, Eddie Vedder, Jamil Hill, and Serpico, of all people, Frank Serpico. Yeah. You know, he's coming.
Prophets of Rage.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this sucker has set loose an army of opposition here in a certain sense in the society, really creating this very strong sort of definition of which side are you on. And it really does come down to that he is, at the same time, he is also trying to build up and reach out to the reactionary, you know, guys that run around with their snout in the dirt all the time. You know, it's sort of, this is the people, like you look at the people that have made all kinds of racist threats against Kaepernick, you know, the people at bars that have, I saw one that had a doormat talking about him being hung, another that has jerseys about him, you know, about him being lynched and all this stuff. It's like, this is the kind
of
stuff.
Rape threats against Jamel Hill, ESPN sportscaster, who's female. And because she's a black woman, she not only gets the racist stuff, but they also the rape threats and the misogynist responses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to get into. And you made a point that people should make no mistake about it from the very beginning. Not that it wasn't that it took all this polarization to actually make this clear. It was clear from the very beginning that this was, in fact, a direct attack on black people.
Yes, and we need to recognize that, because you've got a situation where, I mean, and Jemele Hill got brought into this because she got into a Twitter back and forth where she laid out that Trump is a white supremacist. And the point is, she told the truth. That is real. The man has shown you who he is. He's shown you what motivates him. And it was very important that people like Ta-Nehisi Coates stepped in and not only backed up Jemele Hill, but further developed the argument in terms of Trump and his white supremacy. But you look at what his regime has done, and it's not just looking at what they might do or what's in his heart. Look at what they have done, from the reinstating the mandatory minimum sentences that played a very big part in the war on drugs that led to black and brown people being warehoused in disproportionate numbers in prison, appointing Jeff Sessions as the attorney general, an old and unreconstructed Southerner who, like, thought the KKK was a fine organization till he found out that some of them smoked pot, the talk about taking the gloves off the police, reinstating the policy of giving surplus military equipment to the police to use in ways like they did in Ferguson against the black youth who stood up in protest over the murder of Michael Brown. And then you put that together with the whole program, the Muslim travel bans, the launching of Trump's campaign by calling Mexicans rapists and drug dealers, the intensification of the targeting of especially Latino immigrants for immigration raids that tear families apart. And you have a person, you have a man who is letting you know what he stands for, what's driving him, and where things are going to go. And you have to learn from that and act. And that's why I made the point earlier about you can't just cheer from the sidelines. You got to get in the game. You got to actually, I was listening to the interview with Michael Moore that was on the station earlier, and he made the point about get off of the out of the stands and onto the field. And that is right. People have to do that. And it has to be pointed at, we got to drive this regime out, because when you look at the fact that there's a white supremacist in the White House who has pulled together a regime of white supremacists, climate change deniers, woman haters, immigrant and Muslim bashers, that is unacceptable, and people have to act to stop that. We got to drive this regime out. It's not a thing of waiting till the next election. I mean, these people are working on ethnically cleansing the voting rolls. They've looked at what kinds of people don't vote for them, don't vote for the fascists and the program that they bring forward. And they've got a plan and an agenda to wipe those people from the voting rolls, making it harder for black people, for brown people, and frankly, for students to vote. They do things like make a student ID not an acceptable ID to register to vote, while an NRA card is an acceptable ID to register to vote. They're telling you something. Mm-hmm. You can't say we're going to go after them in the next election, because the next elections may not happen. We got to remember what happened in Nazi Germany and what Hitler did after the Reichstag fire in terms of wiping out the next elections. But we also have to look at the way that they are rigging the elections so that they won't matter, because the people that they know oppose them will have that much more difficulty in terms of even being able to vote. Mm-hmm. And that's the importance of Refuse Fascism and its call for November 4th. For people to take to the streets in cities across the country and stay in the streets day after day and night after night.
Let me ask you this, Carl.
Single demand.
I want to get into that in just a minute, but there's one point I really thought was important to actually hit on, which is, you know, what you were saying, what you were leading up to about the character of all this and where it's going. And I think it's extremely important, because anybody who's read anything about how these various fascist regimes develop, suddenly, you know, and a lot of them, there's a thing where people have seen bit by bit things going and then a leap, and things will get a little bit harder, you know, there'll be bad things happening. But then people tend to get either surprised or they're unprepared or they're not able to. When the time comes, they're not able to actually come out and oppose this the way it is. And I thought that one of the things that a number of people that I haven't seen before have been writing about, like when there's Terrell Germain Williams, a writer who was talking about the blood-drenched flag and saying that Trump is talking about, he says, this is not a flag that we should love. This is a flag that is drenched with the blood of Black and other people of color, which is something that you don't generally see. Or when Jelani Cobb made that point about, you know, just since Kaepernick made his protest, 41 unarmed people have been killed by the police, at least, and 12 of them were Black. You know, you think about what this means in terms of what's actually being carried out in the society right now. And then I'd like to have you comment on that. And then let's get into, yes, the importance of what's happening starting November 4th.
Yeah, see, this is very important. And when they make this point about people have to honor the flag and they have to love the country, and then they're trying to get Black spokespeople to come out and say, oh, don't tell us we're not patriotic. We love the country as much as anybody else. They're really trying to draw you into both the wrong terms, but also getting you to go against your actual interests. I mean, we got to say, what crimes has this country committed? What crimes has this flag flown over? What does it represent and symbolize? And we can go through the history of this country. You know, what flag flew over the genocide that was carried out against the native inhabitants? What flag originally flew over slavery? And then even when slavery was ended, what flag flew over forcing Black people into slavery by another name and the lynchings and all of that? And you actually have two flags coming together, the Confederate flag and the American flag, overseeing all that and giving it the stamp of approval by the refusal of Congress to even say that it was bad that so many Black people were lynched, were being lynched when those thousands of lynchings went down. Because year after year, bills would be raised in Congress and they'd be slapped down. This is the history of this country, to say nothing of the many invasions in different parts of the world and the plunder that goes on that this flag flies under. This is what it represents. And people should not be trapped on the defensive to say, oh no, I'm not disrespecting the flag. Of course I respect that. You got to actually look what it symbolizes, what it represents, and what this country stands for. And I think that's very important. And look, as a revolutionary communist, I have been working for decades to get people to see that all of these horrors are rooted into the very fabric and framework of this system. And the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Bob Avakian, has brought forward the way to get out from under this all the way through revolution, communist revolution. And that's something that we promote and stand for. But right now, the revolution and everybody else is up against a very particular situation. And a stage that we have to go through is driving out this fascist regime before it can consolidate its power. Because a consolidated fascist regime would make it far, 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 far harder to do anything about bringing a better future into being for people. Whether you're for the revolution or not, you have to actually see that any positive change is going to be far, far harder if these fascists are able to consolidate their hold on power. And they are moving towards that. We shouldn't be looking at, oh, well, they've had these legislative failures, because fascists aren't out to pass bills. They're out to impose fascism, taking away rights, taking away the ability to speak out, targeting the press, but also targeting people's rights to dissent. And we have to stop this regime before it can consolidate its power and finish the job on doing that.
So how do you see doing that, man?
Well, that's the point to refuse fascism and its call for November 4th. And it really does have to be in cities across the country that people have to come out on November 4th. And look, it's going to start out in the thousands. That's probably where we're going to be. But we have to, from that beginning, carry forward day after day and night after night, different kinds of protests, focusing in on different targets. Maybe certain days we'd focus in on the taking away of newly won rights from lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning people. Maybe we'd focus on the immigration fight on another day, but day after day and night after night, different protests that are calling forth to people to get off the sidelines and get into the street, get out of the stands and get onto the field and join the fight to drive these fascists out. And see, we have to look at what happened in South Korea only a few months ago. We started out with young people, students, taking to the street against the hated regime, but then stayed in the streets for weeks and even several months, where it built up and the trade unions, the labor unions joined in, church groups, various professional associations joined in, and they were able to build up the strength to drive a hated regime out. And see, there's even more at stake for humanity in this. Because, look, there was a lot at stake in South Korea in terms of what that regime stood for. But this is not just a problem for the people in this country. You got a president who went to the United Nations and said, we'll destroy North Korea if we have to. That's a country of 25 million people. This could lead to an exchange of nuclear weapons that would not only kill millions of people, but would affect the environment of the very planet that we live on. In the name of humanity, we must end this nightmare by driving out the Trump-Pence regime. And November 4th, it begins.
So that's the point, is that November 4th is the first step in what could be a really historic, world historic situation in terms of driving out this fascist. And actually, you know, and it is, it's something I was thinking about, something that you said in your statement on the Kaepernick stuff and on what's happening in the among the football players, among athletes, and broadly in society. You said, if you have made your peace with 3 or 7 more years of this lynch mob master, of this lunatic with his finger on the nuclear button, what have you made your peace with? And that's a question I think people really have to, whatever degree you have justified not doing everything you can to drive this, you know, monster out of this his whole regime, then you have to actually really answer that question. What the hell is it that you've made your peace with, and how can you do that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question, and people need to confront that. I mean, I was looking at 2 other articles that came out recently. Actually, both of them happened to be by Bob Avakian. One of them is where he talks about a country ruled by white supremacists. Since when is that acceptable? And he poses the same kind of question. Mm-hmm. This is the reality, and recognizing that reality, is this something that people just have to accept? Is it something that they can wait or should wait until some future election for, or not? And, you know, definitely you shouldn't. And an article that he did, A Question, A Challenge for Paul Krugman and All Those Concerned About the Future of Humanity. Both of these are very important. And people can go to the website revcom.us and find those articles in addition to the article that I wrote on the furor around taking a knee. And people need to go to refusefascism.org and they need to get involved, because this regime is a nightmare, and it's a nightmare that it is up to us to act to end. It's not going to be ended by somebody else. It requires the masses of people, the people who agonize over every step this regime takes, to get into the fray and act to end it itself. Because if you wait for other forces to end it, you may be waiting forever. You know, like Pastor Niemöller said, first they came for the communists and I didn't act because I wasn't a communist. And then he went on through the groups. Well, they have already started coming for people, for immigrants, for Muslims, for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Mm-hmm. You can't wait for that. And then the other thing is, if forces at the top resolve it, they're not going to resolve it in the interest of the people whose lives are being devastated by the intensification of all the horrors that the capitalist system has already been bringing down on people by this fascist regime. They're going to resolve it. The Democrats will resolve it on terms that keep capitalism and all of its horrors in effect, and will intensify them in their own ways.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carl Dix, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, I want to thank you for having me on again, Mike.
Yeah, and we'll have you on again soon. Take care, man.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix. And Carl is a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's a co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. And he was talking with us about Trump and all the white racist supremacy things that are going on around that, and about November 4th and the importance of that. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Perry from Refuse Fascism LA, so stay tuned. Was Not in Our Name by Savage Rose. And joining us right now to continue this conversation is Perry from the Refuse Fascism LA chapter. Perry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael.
Sure. Good to hear you, man.
Good to hear you.
Okay. Now that we got that straight, we can just sit around and talk and not worry about it, all right? Let's jump into this, man. Well, one thing is that November 4th and beyond sort of got announced the other day in a really creative fashion, and you were part of it, which involved, and I know there was probably a lot of people sitting in their cars stomping on the, their horn and stuff, but at the same time, when people found out about this, I think it had to give their heart a little zing in it. So let's talk about what happened that day.
Well, we decided that we had to get the word out about November 4th, in any way we could, and we need November 4th. I mean, basically, we need everybody, so we need everybody to know about it, and just demonstrating in conventional fashion or doing social media online just doesn't seem like it's enough. So we decided that we would shut down the 101 freeway in Los Angeles by marching out into traffic with 12 signs, each with a single letter that read November 4th, NOV4, it begins.
You know, it's interesting because I was telling my assistant producer the other day about, I said, how the hell did they get out and stop that on that freeway? And he was saying, just think about when you drive over to the station in the morning and all this other stuff, and think how you could get out there and do it. But still, I know people on that freeway, it's like, are really possessed with going in. So I thought, damn, that was good.
So we scouted out different locations, and it was very carefully planned, both the location and the timing. I mean, we picked, the height of rush hour, and the traffic would be almost at a standstill. Mm-hmm. And we measured everything and calculated how many people we'd need. And, we didn't want to endanger anyone. Right. And even inconveniencing people was just a byproduct of that wasn't our primary intention.
Mm-hmm. Now, people were arrested, right?
Yeah, all eight of us. There were eight of us, and we were all arrested.
And
we spent the day.
What were the charges?
Well, the charges were trespassing, which apparently you can be charged with trespassing as a misdemeanor or a felony. And ultimately, we were only charged with a misdemeanor. And we have a court date in October.
Mm-hmm.
The odd thing is that they, if you're charged with a misdemeanor, generally you're booked and you're out within a couple of hours, and they kept us in well into the evening. And apparently their systems were down mysteriously, repeatedly, which made it impossible for them to get us out. But our lawyers calling, and eventually they did get us out.
And when they said to you that their systems were down, you said, you have no idea. You have no idea what that's going to mean come November 4th, right?
I've worked with computers for a long time, and I remember systems used to go down in the 1990s. They don't really go down that much anymore, so it was strange. But
use it as another way to agitate around what's going to happen on November 4th. Important, okay?
Yeah.
People got to know about that. Let's jump into this. What is it that you're saying to people when you're talking to people about what's going to happen here in LA and why they need to get up out of whatever they're doing and be part of this?
Well, first let me talk a little bit about why we did this specific action. I mean, it was, it comes under the heading of civil disobedience, and it's something that was illegal, and it was stepping out of normal channel. And part of that was what I said before. We really felt like we had to get the word out, and, we feel like we did. The video's been viewed 750,000 times already. But the thing is, we also did this to kind of model for other people the kinds of things that we're going to have to do to take care of this. We have to step out of normal channels. This is no time for business as usual. Every day this regime stays in power, it does incalculable damage to the people of this country and the rest of the world. We can't even keep track of every outrage. Each week just brings something new that kind of wipes out what we were protesting the week before. And, you know, there are real consequences to this, and they're in real time, and they're also long term. They're laying the foundation for a complete reordering of society, and they're well on their way. And it's people who think we need to just kind of stick within the normal ways of doing things, that we need to kind of petition our representatives and sign petitions and wait for the midterms and work to get better candidates in. All of that is necessary and should happen, but it's not enough. It's just not enough. And even the things that we see that, you know, might happen, I mean, Trump might be impeached, who knows? You know, those would be a step in the right direction, but they would only be a step because those guys are just, you know, they're the figureheads at this point. They're putting so much stuff into place under the surface that barely gets reported on at all, and it's disastrous. And I'm aghast that this is going on and that it's gotten as far as it has, and even just waiting for impeachment. I mean, why isn't he impeached already? He's committed countless impeachable offenses. And we all know it. I mean, there's not any doubt. I mean, we're waiting for Mueller to get going with his investigation, but we already know, you know, even just, you know, the corruption, and it's just beyond a level we've ever seen, whether it's Democrat or Republican, even the most far right. We've had in the past, like Bush, it has never been anything like this.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm speaking today with Perry from Refuse Fascism Los Angeles. And we're talking about November 4th. It begins, and if you want to know what it is that's beginning, you got to pay close attention to the rest of this discussion. And go to refusefascism.org to get the full picture.
Well, you're dealing with a system that's so massively in crisis, and it's got to reorient all this stuff. Trump is a fascist, and Trump is someone who's got an idea and a program for reordering society, and it's built on the oppression of all these people that we've been talking about, whether it's gay people and whether it's black people, whether it's, you know, oppressed nationalities, immigrants, women. Yep. This is all part of this system is actually...
Totally. But the thing I would just add to that is it's not just Trump, and in fact, it's part of the narrative that's being pushed now is that Trump, a lot of people think Trump is either losing it or he's out of his mind, which may well be true. But even so, it's not just Trump who's a fascist. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of them in there. In fact, I would say at a certain point, if you don't oppose him, you are at least collaborating with fascism. And, you know, if you look at history, collaborators, basically, we don't really make such black or white distinctions between whether you were, in fact, someone who believed in fascism and its goals or whether you were someone who just went along with it. And people are going along with it. That's the path to just utter disaster.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit, because November 4th is the beginning of an effort to drive out the entire regime and not just have Trump impeached or so-and-so removed, but actually to drive out this entire regime. So let's give people a sense of what do you hope it looks like? What will it mean from November 4th? Start with that and then on.
Okay. So November 4th, in Los Angeles, certainly we want massive demonstrations. Scale-wise, I guess the most recent thing to compare to would be the Women's March, where 750,000 people took over downtown, completely shut it down, and basically created a massive, massive demonstration. And so we're hoping that we get something like that. We don't know if we'll be able to, but that's the hope. And then the difference is we're not going home afterwards. And this is a kickoff to a sustained campaign in the streets to just stop business as usual and just force the powers that be to deal with this crisis that they've created. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't get to choose exactly what happens or what direction it goes. We just know it has to stop. And our representatives are just that. They're our representatives, and they're working for us, and we have to get them to do what's necessary, which is to drive out this regime. It's hard to say before they do such, because they've already done all of it. The reason that we have to do it now is that they're fascists, and fascism progresses. Fascism is a dynamic force that doesn't stop. It just progresses. It has its own dynamic, and even if the people who've put it in motion later on have second thoughts, at a certain point it becomes like a steamroller that you just can't stop, and we're really close to that now. And we feel that this is, I mean, there's always things you can do and there's always hope, but it's going to get immeasurably harder the longer this goes on. It's already getting harder. The other side of the massive views of the video are the comments, and there's a lot of people who basically just, Trump has licensed the most brutal fantasies about, I mean, there's far more comments from people who, I mean, and many of them are probably trolls and bots, but who just would, why didn't they just run us down? What, you know, that's what they would have done. Mm-hmm. And this is not normal. Mm-hmm. And these things come from the top. And this is the kind of thing that Trump has unleashed.
Mm-hmm. All right, Perry, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want people to know that November 4th, that's the day people got to keep their eyes on, November 4th. And you're telling people to be out in the streets November 4th and be there and stay there and be in the public square and don't be square. Okay. That's the
Exactly. And our plans, I mean, we'll flesh out our plans to get permits and let people know where and when and all of that. That's all coming.
And if people want to get in touch with you, let me read these ways. It's refusefascism.org. And then on Facebook, it's facebook.com/refusefascism, right?
That's correct.
All right, Perry. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael. A pleasure.
Sure. Talk to you again, man. Bye. All right. We're going to take a musical break right now. And Kiana, I want to listen to Lupe Fiasco about breaking the chains, because right about now, that's what I feel like we all got to get down on, breaking them damn chains. All right. So let's listen to a little Lupe Fiasco while we usher our next guest in.
I waited all my life to play, but I still can't find a way. I might just break the chains. I might just break the chains. I might just break the chains. Especially where we from, where we grew up like a green thumbs, like a criminal, the only thing we could become. Look at what I became, something like a phenom, nothing but a G-thang. Things I've seen when I'm looking out of these frames, pictures I painted on the walls where we hang. From the trees we hung, strange fruit man, look at how we swung. How the hell you gonna tell a son who ain't have a father how to try to grow up and be one? See, feel it in my bones that I'm sitting on the throne, like a killer with the chrome when I'm spitting out the poem. Shed a whole lot of light on a little bit of home. Bam.
All right, people wait all their lives to just taste, have a little taste of freedom and have a little taste of not having to carry chains around, symbolic and real. All right, and that's what the show's about today. And that was Lupe Fiasco, and the piece was Break the Chains. Now, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show two people who, I got to tell you, I went to the opening of this play. As everybody knows, I really love theater when I come onto the show, right? Even off the show. But I do a lot of interviews with people in theater around the show. And I went, and the play was called Runaway Home. And it was a play by Jeremy Camp. And it was just a mind blower. I mean, it was one of these plays where you at the end of it, you're like, no, I'm not leaving my seat until something more comes out. I was really pleased. I just talked about it with people for, you know, endlessly about it. So I wanted, two of the actors in the show are here with me today. All right. And I want to welcome Karen Molina White.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Michael.
Yeah. Good to have you. And Camille Spearlin.
Yes. Hi.
There you go. Hi.
Thank you for having
us. Now you got to sit over there, and I want to see your hands on the table.
Nobody trusts me.
No, you know what? I loved you in that, and I thought it was just sort of, you were really incredible. And we'll talk about this, but I want to start with you first, Molina.
Yes.
Okay. Tell us what the play is about.
The play, it's a post Katrina play. Takes place 3 years after the hurricane, and it lower Ninth Ward. So where people got hit the most, and it's told through the story of a 14-year-old girl, and at the center of the story is her relationship with her mom, who went through the hurricane and lost her grandmother. But it's also about the community that they have to come back to after once being displaced.
And can you add to that?
We're all just looking for a home. Mm-hmm. I'm just another girl running. Everything that you just said, and also that we need to leave the past where the past is and just keep pushing forward and making our new truth.
But actually, you know, one thing, and this is for both of you to talk about, because, you know, I'll tell you, I think that when you said that leave the past where it is, you know, and Camille, your character doesn't so much leave the past where it is, but actually struggles to forge a whole new future based on what has been, what has happened, what has gone on. And I thought, you know, the way you carry this out, and I have to tell people, You play, how old is that? Is the young woman you play?
She's 14 and a half.
She's 14 and a half.
14.
Yeah. You see that? Yeah, my kid used to talk about it. You know, no, man, he turned 12 and it was like a month after his birthday. I'm almost 13, man. You can't control me, you know. I can be free at 13, right? It's sort of, you know, but you play this young woman and you play it with such vigor. I mean, it's really, and you really become this person and in every way. And there's the way that you see... I'll just say something about the character of your character, which is, in a lot of ways, you're up against a world that you just don't accept. You don't understand and you don't accept. And you're not going to let it crush you. And so you got a big mouth and you're not afraid to use it. But you also use it oftentimes for some of the most remarkable. And I want to ask you about this. You spit a lot of rhymes when you're there. And some of the most remarkable ones in terms, and I know it comes from the person that wrote the play, but your role in actually doing that, because I imagine that isn't so different from, I mean, you're part of that generation where that actually is the culture, the art that actually has meant a lot, not to everybody, but has meant a lot to people who are growing up in that generation, that art. And I thought the way you captured a lot of the essence of the story in the rhymes was just incredible.
Thank you. Couldn't have done it without Shirley Joe and Jeremy Camps leading me. It was a lot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, did you, you got to go a little longer than that. Well, think about, because I'm going to come back to you on this, because it's you actually, your character is sort of a pivotal point. And at the same time, actually, you know, it's, now I should call you Karen, not Melina, right?
Karen Molina.
Karen Molina. Oh, you're going to make me say two names.
No,
now.
You can say either one. Either one works.
Okay. All right, Mrs. White.
There you go.
No. All right, Karen Molina. Your character actually is someone who, you know, it's interesting because you have all this craziness around you, but you're steady on until you're confronted with the craziness is there until somebody's going to have to do something. Let's talk about your character, what you found in that.
Yeah, my character is kind of like the unofficial mayor of the Lower Ninth Ward, but she represents the voice of the poor people, the people who get looked over, the people who are taken care of last. She's the one who stayed in the community to try to protect the homes of her community. She represents the voice of those who've gotten taken advantage of, whether it's claims insurance people, whether it's the government, FEMA, you know, as we see and continue to see with, you know, all the hurricane and tragedies, you know, how people prey on the poor and that motivation of greed. You know, we see in Sandy Hook all of the claims adjusters, you know, taking advantage of people and the fine line and not giving them what they, you know, flood insurance and all these kinds of things. And so she's one who's trying to hold on to her community, to preserve it and to keep it for the people who had lived their lives there, generations of generations, as opposed to the people who want to come in and remove the houses and take advantage of it and, you know, start to rebuild and, you know, more, also like gentrification, you know. A lot of black homes, black communities are being lost to these kinds of things. And so she's the voice of the people. For sure.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with actress Camille Spearlin and Karen Molina White from the play Runaway Home, a play by Jeremy J. Kemps.
And actually, that is something that really stands in, and it may be in the background for a long time, but it actually, as the play goes on, it poses itself. And I was thinking about that because I was reading some about the author of the play, and I had gone to New Orleans right after, pretty soon after Katrina, and was down there for a couple weeks, and I went for the station, and I was recording interviews with people and stuff, and it was very, very heavy, because what you saw, and having gone to New Orleans many times in my youth, and then throughout it later on, and you know, going to visit people or hang out or do whatever, it was something that you saw that when you went down there, it wasn't just that the storm was so bad, but that And it wasn't just that people lost their homes, bad as that was. It was actually, there was a real fight to almost lose the people. I mean, it was to push the people out. I mean, I went to Texas after spending a couple weeks in New Orleans, and I went to Texas and I saw these tens of thousands of people who had been driven from New Orleans.
Right.
Living, and like this one woman was living with her, with somebody who just went down. This woman saw the people in the stadium there in Texas, in Houston. And she went down and she just grabbed a bunch of people and she said, come back to my house. And so she brought this woman with her, all of her entire family, which was about 12 people. And as she's sitting there, the woman said that her mother had sent her to this stadium to get people. And her mother was sitting there and her mother said, and her mother must have been like,
she was really old. She was really old. Mm-hmm. I mean, she might have been close to 100. Mm-hmm. And she just said, the stories of when they kept us in chains and sold us like we were cattle never left my mind when I was seeing what was happening. And that's a big part of what's being posed in the play itself, you know, when you look at that. And that's why I thought that Break the Chains was actually important in this, but it's also something that we have to deal with, that people have to recognize that that's actually what was going on. There is this genocidal swing to things.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of PTSD, you know. I mean, people who've been displaced, a lot of people from after Katrina, they were put on planes. They didn't even know where they were going. You know, you look at the movie When the Levees Broke and just hear all the personal testimonies and stories of these people just really suffered. A lot of people still couldn't come back, couldn't afford to come back and rebuild their houses and, you know, are still in Houston or, you know, other places. A lot came out here to L.A. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have to deal with rebuilding and getting assistance. And, you know, so we're going to see what's going to happen to the people of Puerto Rico, you know, just that madness there. So, yeah, it's long lasting. You never forget it. And I think this little girl in this story, at this young age, what she goes through and how that affects her. And I think that's the heart of the story, too. The children are affected.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, I want to thank you for for pointing the finger in that direction.
Yes.
Hi. What do you think about this?
I definitely think Holly, especially, she's not only been through a lot, but she has to live this for the rest of her life. This will never be erased from her mind. And just the fact that having to go that deep into this character was very hard. Not only am I just trying to bring to life a character, but also all the children of Katrina who went through this, and watching the documentary Children in the Storm and how they were just, I didn't know how to swim. I didn't know what was going to happen to my mom. I was put on a boat. I was put on the freeway. It was tough. And the fact that this little girl uses her diary to get through everything. And not only does she not have her diary, she has to keep it in her head and constantly go through those thoughts. It's a lot. It's PTSD. But it's also therapeutic. She's getting through it. And finally, she breaks free.
And with her, what you see, because you see that the playwright has painted a character who, and I've seen this too. I mean, I met a guy down there who would... he was on a bridge. He was on one of the bridges, and he had diabetes, and he got real sick, and he passed out, and people tried to get him to a hospital. Then the cops came, and they took him to the hospital. But then when he woke up, his entire family was spread to the wind. He had no way. His cell phone didn't work. He didn't have it anymore, something like that. His family didn't have cell phones anymore. They had no idea. How do you find yourself? How do you find your family? And in a way, I thought that was one of the things, Camille, that your character was actually really trying to struggle with. Because in a certain sense, like, your character actually was there and was trying to pull stuff together. But you were not.
No.
And then you come into a whole different life where you go from being this young woman who won a spelling bee.
Mm-hmm. Second place.
But had that trophy.
Yes.
And had that in your head. And it really meant something to you, too. You were then... washed away. That character got washed away a little bit, and you had to deal with a whole new set of reality, you know, which was actually I found it very heavy. And the way you walked through that, maintaining that sort of that innocence and sort of like, I can do anything of young people in the best of circumstances, but you maintain that. And actually there was always that, no matter how hard, and you were very good at presenting it as, you're really hard, but then your heart is there. Even in the trickery you play on people, I was like, you can't, no, he's my age, you can't treat him like that. But it was heavy, and that must have been a heavy thing to do, to try and actually maintain that combination of the innocence of childhood and the eagerness to be out in the world. At the same time, you're in a world that has nothing for you.
Right.
You know, which was really, and that's something people are going through a lot today.
Yes, and I feel that with Kali, too, the guidance of her grandmother really, really stuck with her, and I feel... by the grace of God, that everybody who's going through Hurricane Harvey and everything, and that they can find that voice, they can find something and really, really pull through. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me something, because you did a lot of rhyming. Did you actually, do you do that outside of?
Yes, yeah? I do, yes.
Could you do something for people now from the show?
From the show, yes.
Okay, why don't you do that?
Of course, of course. Dear Diary, I've stolen, I've cussed, yeah, I have missed the bus. Look, I've scratched girls' skin so deep that they bleed. I refuse to let my teachers teach me how to read. I had to learn for myself. I'm a truant and a juvie. I make out with boys in backs of movies. I'm a flirt gone too far, having a baby as a teen. But did you know? I'm truly a queen. I used to rule over these swamps and hills and work this Delta land. Picking cotton, pouring tea, wore both shackles on my ankle and the same time, a crown made of gold. I am the slave and the goddess. The greatest stories never told.
Yeah. Brought to you by 14-year-old.
There you go. There you go. There you go. See, folks, that's the beauty of it. Now, moving back to you, madam, because you actually, in a certain sense, it is true that you play that role that you're really frustrated. And I have to admit, you're surrounded by a lot of frustrating people that you have to rely on to a certain extent. But you're also you're someone who is like, now, your character didn't leave the Ninth Ward, right?
Right.
And stayed there and kind of was the sort of the guard planted at the gate kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And as you were saying earlier, that you had to face, you know, your character had to face a lot of the stuff of like people coming in, the people trying to grab the land, grab the houses, people not being able to come back. And I thought that the way you actually put that was, you know, in the way you carried that out, because your character always maintained authority, but a softness too. And especially when it was for your friend, you know, when it was Kali's mom, she was messed up for about 12 people, folks. She had gone through a lot. In the initial part of the play, you just think she's like, damn, she's mean. She's all about herself. That's all she, but then as her character unfolds, you begin to understand all the things that happened to her and what brought her there. But you knew that, and your character actually played a really important role in terms of the heartbeat, in a way, the heartbeat of the whole play. It was kind of, I really enjoyed that. I thought you did a really good job at it, but I wonder how you felt about that too.
Thank you. I felt good about it. I really liked the character. Really resonated with her. Her name is Shauna, and I think she's, you know, she's like you said, she's the heart. She's the rock of the community, and she was one who stayed. You know, whether she had to live in her trailer for how long, or you know, whether her house was, you know, just okay enough for her to live in, but. You know, we see all kinds of people, and yes, Kali's mother Eunice, she had to leave her mother there. Right? They were in a boat. The mother dies in a boat, and they have to push the mother's dead body out of the boat in order to let some more people who are stranded on the roof into. So that just, you know, that's what's at, you know, the bottom of her. You know, she can't wrestle with that. You know, there was no body to bury. She never knew what happened to that body. And so, you know, this is the pain that she goes through. And she never really had a relationship with a daughter. So now she has to forge one. They have to create a new relationship with them. The mother was always there, you know, binding them. But now the mother's gone. And so at the end of the play, you know, New Orleans and their funerals, you know, they have this joyous funeral. They do a second line. They play music. And finally, at the end of the play, you know, these three women, they get to dance and they get to, you know, bury their mother properly, you know, her neighbor, the oldest, you know, neighbor in the community. So it's full of laughter in the play. It's a lot of heart. It speaks to a lot of things that's happening. So it's very topical. But you get to see all kinds of characters. You get to see the oldest male in the community, and you know, and how important he is. And you get to see this white guy, brilliantly played by Brian Tichenor, comes in, and you know, he's one of those people that come in. He comes in from Michigan. He wants to help. Very empathetic, you know. And so those people are there. And, you know, you get to see the relationship of him to the being an outsider to the community. So Jeremy has just done a really great job. Shirley Jo Finney just putting all together under her direction and vision. And we're just happy to be a part of this new play, this journey. So it's been a treat.
Yeah. And I just have to say this. I don't want you to get upset. All right, Camille, because your character, that guy that came in from Michigan or whatever it was, got his butt kicked. Metaphorically, by a 14-year-old, who basically just put him on the sidelines. Yeah. But it was really beautifully done. And I have to tell you, both of you folks are really, really great in it.
Thank you.
I really, you know, I was thinking, God, we should just get the whole cast if we could, because the man that plays the old man,
really
Jairus Poindexter, yeah. Armando Ray. He's the voice of the Latino immigrant. You know, a lot of Latinos were bused there to help rebuild these homes. You know, so they're in that community as well. Jeremy did a great job of having so many points of view.
That's right. And now we have to wrap this up because they're going to start waving, throwing rocks at the window if we don't get out of here. Okay. So we've been talking with actors Camille Spearlin and Karen Molina White from Runaway Home, and it's a play by Jeffrey Camps. I want to thank both you guys for joining us today. Right? It's been really incredibly nice talking with you and a really good experience seeing it.
All right, before I go, I'm going to make a special announcement. So let's give a listen to the following.
Those this system has cast off, those it has treated as less than human, can be the backbone and driving force of a fight not only to end their own oppression, but to finally end all oppression and emancipate all of humanity.
That was Bob Avakian, B.A., the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's a clip from the film B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. In the fall of 2012, Bob Avakian gave a series of talks in different cities around the country. This is a film of one of those talks. The special announcement is that this groundbreaking work is now available online for everyone to reach and listen to. The entire film, as well as a whole lot of clips, can be watched at revolutiontalk.net. Once again, that's revolutiontalk.net. You can also go to the Revolution Talk channel on Vimeo, and you can find links to all of this at revcom.us and on my Facebook page as well. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my guests, Carl Dix, Perry from Refuse Fascism Los Angeles, and Camille Spearlin and Karen Molina White. I also want to thank the people who work so hard on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Kiana Williams. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a version of The Clash's Guns of Brixton, but this version is by a group called Chicha Libre, and it's a really tight version, so check it out.
Y como dice Rubén, un carro pasa muy despacito por la avenida. No tiene marca, pero todos saben que es policía. Cuidado con las armas de Brixton.
Your hat to answer to.